"'Odd out here, doesn't it? But I think trees will grow. I've made some plantings down below.'
"'I'd love to see them,' she said. "'Sometimes I'd give almost anything to get into a deep, shady woods, just to smell it and feel how cool. "'There's a little story connected with these,' Mr. Garfield said. "'He spoke warmly to the mother alone. "'When we first decided to come out here, I said to Martha that if trees wouldn't grow, we shouldn't stick it. "'That's just what I said. If trees won't grow there, we shan't stick it. "'Trees are like the breath of life to me.'
The boy's father was shaken by a sudden spell of coughing, and his wife shot a look at him and then looked back at Mr. Garfield with a light flush on her cheekbones.
"'I'd love to see them,' she said again. "'I was raised in Minnesota, and I never will get used to a place as barren as this. "'When I think of the beaches back home in England,' Mr. Garfield said, and shook his head.
Beau lifted himself heavily out of his chair and followed the rest of them out to the coulee edge. Below them, willows grew in a thin belt along the almost dry creek, and farther back from the water there were perhaps 20 cottonwoods, a half dozen feet high.
"'I'm trying cottonwoods first, because they can stand drought,' Mr. Garfield said.
Elsa was looking down with all her longing plain and naked in her face.
"'It's wonderful,' she said. "'I'd give almost anything to have some on our place.'
"'I found the willows near here,' Mr. Garfield said, "'just at the south end of the hills they call the old man on his back, "'where a stream comes down.'
"'Stream?' the boy's father said. "'You mean that spring-month trickle?'
"'It's not much of a stream,' Mr. Garfield said apologetically. "'But
are there any more there?' Elsa said.
"'Oh, yes, you could get some.' "'Cut them slanting and push them into any damp ground. They'll grow.'
"'They'll grow about 6 feet high,' Beau Mason said.
"'Yes,' said Mr. Garfield. "'They're not, properly speaking, trees. Still—'
Beau Mason looked at the southwest.
"'It's getting pretty smothery,' he said, rather loudly. "'We'd better be getting on.'
This time Mr. Garfield didn't object, and they went back to the car with Mrs. Garfield and the boy's mother exchanging promises of visits. Beau turned the crank and climbed into the Ford, where the boy was sighting along his gun.
"'Put that down,' his father said. "'Don't you know any better than to point a gun around people?'
"'It isn't loaded.'
"'They never are. Put it down now.'
The Garfields were standing with their arms around each other's waists, waiting to wave goodbye. Mr. Garfield reached over and picked something from his wife's dress.
"'What was it, Alfred?'
she said, peering.
"'Nothing. Only a bit of fluff.'
The boy's father coughed violently, and the car started with a jerk. With his head down almost on the wheel, still coughing, he waved, and the mother and the boy waved as they went down along the badly set cedar posts of the pasture fence. They were almost a quarter of a mile away before the boy, with a last flourish of the gun, turned around to see that his father was not coughing, but laughing. He rocked the car with his joy, and when Elsa said,
"'Oh, Beau, you big fool!'
he pointed helplessly to his shoulder.
"'Would you mind,' he said, "'would you mind brushing that bit of fluff off me shoulder?'
He rocked again, pounding the wheel.
"'I can't stick it,' he said. "'I bloody well can't stick it, you know.'
"'It isn't fair to laugh at him,' she said. "'He can't help being English.'
"'He can't help being a sanctimonious old mud-hen, either,' he said, braying about his lovely, lovely trees. "'They'll freeze out the first cold winter.'
"'How do you know? Maybe it's like he says. If they get a start, they'll grow here as well as anywhere.
Maybe there's a gold mine in our backyard, too, but I'm not going to dig to see. I couldn't stick it.'
"'You're just being stubborn,' she said. "'Just because you didn't like him—'
He turned on her in a heavy amazement.
"'Well, my God, did you?'
"'I thought he was very nice,' she said,
and sat straighter in the back seat, speaking loudly above the jolting of the springs and the cough of the motor.
"'They're trying to make a home, not just a wheat crop. I liked them.'
"'Uh-huh.'
He was not laughing any more now. Sitting beside him, the boy could see that his face had hardened, and that the cold look had come into his eyes again. "So I should start talking like I had a mouthful of bran and planting trees around the house that'll look like clothesline poles in 2 months."
"I didn't say that."
"You thought it, though." He looked irritably at the sky, misted with the same delusive film of haze or cloud that had fooled him for 3 days. "You thought it all the time we were there."
"Why aren't you more like Mr. Garfield? He's such a nice man."
With mincing savagery, he swung around and mocked her.
"Shall I make it a walnut grove, or a sugar orchard, or maybe you'd prefer orange trees?"
The boy was squinting down his gun, trying not to hear them quarrel, but he knew what his mother's face would be like, hurt and a little flushed, and her chin trembling into stubbornness.
"I don't suppose you could bear to have a rug on the floor, or a gramophone," she said.
He smacked the wheel hard. "Of course I could bear it if we could afford it. I'd love it. But I don't know what you think is going to give us the dough for things like that if a wind comes up out of that heat hole over there, and I'd a damn sight rather do without than be like that old sandhill crane."
"I don't suppose you'd like to take me over to the old man on his back some day to get some willow slips, either."
"What for?"
"To plant down in the coulee by the dam."
"That dam dries up every August. Your willows wouldn't live till snow flies."
"Well, would it do any harm to try?"
"Oh, shut up," he said. "Just thinking about that guy and his fluff and his trees gives me the pleafer." The topless Ford lurched, one wheel at a time, through the deep burnout by their pasture corner, and the boy clambered out with his gun in his hand to slip the loop of the three-strand gate. It was then that he saw the snake, a striped, limp ribbon dangling on the fence, and a moment later the sparrow, neatly butchered and hung by the throat on a barb. He pointed the gun at them.
"Look it," he said. "Look at what the butcher bird's been doing."
His father's violent hand waved at him from the car. "Come on, get the wire out of the way." The boy dragged the gate through the dust, and the Ford went through and up behind the house, framed by the fire guard overgrown with Russian thistle. Walking across that yard a few minutes later, the boy felt its hard heat through his sneakers. There was hardly a spear of grass within the fire guard. It was one of his father's prides that the dooryard should be like cement. "Pour your wash water out long enough," he said, "and you'll have a surface so hard it won't even make mud." Religiously, he threw his water out 3 times a day, carrying it sometimes a dozen steps to dump it on a dusty or grassy spot. Elsa had objected at first, asking why they had to live in the middle of an alkali flat and why they couldn't let grass grow up to the door. But he snorted her down. "Everything around the house ought to be bare as a bone. Get a good grass fire going and it would jump that guard like nothing. And if they had grass to the door, where would they be?"
She said, "Why not plow a wider guard, then? One a fire couldn't jump."
But he said he had other things to do than plowing 50-foot fire guards. They were arguing inside when the boy came up the step to sit down and aim his empty .22 at a fence post. Apparently his mother had been persistent, and persistence, when he was not in a mood for it, angered his father worse than anything. Their talk came vaguely through the boy's concentration, but he shut his ears on it. If that spot on the post was a coyote now, and he held the sight steady right on it and pulled the trigger, that old coyote would jump about 80 feet in the air and come down dead as a mackerel, and he could tack his hide on the barn the way Mr. Larson had one, only the dogs had jumped and torn the tail and hind legs off Mr. Larson's, and he wouldn't get more than the $3 bounty for its ears. But Mr. Larson had shot his with a shotgun anyway, and the hide wasn't worth much even before the dogs tore it.
"I can't for the life of me see why not," his mother said inside. "We could do it now. We're not doing anything else."
"I tell you, they wouldn't grow," his father said with emphasis on every word. "Why should we run our tongues out doing everything that mealy-mouth fool does?"
"I don't want anything but the willows. They're easy."
He made his special sound of contempt, half snort and half grunt. After a silence, she tried again.
"They might even have pussies on them in the spring. Mr. Garfield thinks they'd grow, and his wife told me he used to work in a greenhouse.
This isn't a greenhouse, for Christ's sake. Go outside and feel that breeze if you think so.
Oh, let it go, she said. I've stood it this long without any green things around. I guess I can stand it some more.
The boy, aiming now toward the gate where the butcher bird, coming back to his prey, would in just a second fly right into Deadeye's unerring bullet, heard his father stand up suddenly.
"Abused, aren't you?" he said.
His mother's voice rose.
"No, I'm not abused. Only I don't see why it would be so awful to get some willows. Just because Mr. Garfield gave me the idea and you don't like him."
"You're right, I don't like him. He gives me a pain right under the crupper."
"Because," his mother's voice said bitterly, "he calls his wife dear and puts his arm around her and likes trees. It wouldn't occur to you to put your arm around your wife, would it?"
The boy aimed and held his breath. His mother ought to keep still, because if she didn't, she'd get him real mad, and then they'd both have to tiptoe around the rest of the day. He heard his father's breath whistle through his teeth and his mincing, nasty voice.
"Would you like me to put my arm around you now, dear?"
"I wouldn't let you touch me with a 10-foot pole," his mother said.
She sounded just as mad as he did, and it wasn't often she let herself get that way. The boy squirmed over when he heard the quick, hard steps come up behind him and pause. Then his father's hand, brown and meaty and felted with fine black hair, reached down over his shoulder and took the .22.
"Let's see this cannon old Scissorbill gave you," he said.
It was a single-shot, bolt-action Savage, a little rusty on the barrel, the bolt sticky with hardened grease when he removed it. Sighting up through the barrel, he grunted.
"Takes care of a gun like he sets a fence. Probably used it to cultivate his lovely trees."
He went out into the porch, and after a minute came back with a rag and a can of machine oil. Hunching the boy over on the step, he sat down and began rubbing the bolt with the oil-soaked rag.
"I just can't bear to shoot anything any more," he said, and laughed suddenly. "I just can't stick it, little man."
He leered at the boy, who grinned back uncertainly. Squinting through the barrel again, his father breathed through his nose and clamped his lips together, shaking his head. The sun lay heavy on the baked yard. Out over the corner of the pasture a soaring hawk caught wind and sun at the same time, so that his light breast feathers flashed as he banked and rose.
"Just wait," the boy said. "Wait till I get my gun working, and I'll fix you, you hen robber."
He thought of the three chicks a hawk had struck earlier in the summer, the three balls of yellow with the barred, mature plumage just showing through. Two of them dead before he got there and chased the hawk away, the other with its crop slashed open and wheat spilling from it to the ground. His mother had sowed up the crop, and the chicken had lived, but it always looked droopy, like a plant in drought time, and sometimes it stood working its bill as if choking.
"By golly," he thought, "I'll shoot every hawk and butcher bird in 20 miles. I'll
rustle around and find me a piece of baling wire," his father said. "This barrel looks like a hen roost."
Behind the house he found a piece of rusty wire, brought it back, and watched his father straighten it, wind a piece of rag around the end, ram it up and down through the barrel, and peer through again.
"He's leaded her so you can hardly see the grooves," he said. "But maybe she'll shoot. We'll fill her with vinegar and cork her up tonight."
Elsa was behind them, leaning against the jamb and watching. She reached down and rumpled Beau's black hair.
"The minute you get a gun in your hands, you start feeling better," she said. "It's just a shame you weren't born 100 years sooner."
"A gun's a good tool," he said. "It hadn't ought to be misused. Gun like this is enough to make a guy cry."
"Well, you've at least got to admit it was nice of him to give it to Bruce," she said.
It was the wrong thing to say. The boy had a feeling that she knew it was the wrong thing to say, that she said it anyway just to have one tiny triumph over him. Even before he heard his father's answer, he knew Pa would be mad again.
Oh, sure, he said. Mr. Garfield's a fine man. He can preach a better sermon than anybody in Saskatchewan. God almighty, I get sick of hearing his praises sung. If you like it so well, why don't you move over there?
If you weren't so blind stubborn, he rose with the .22 in his hand and brushed past her into the house.
I'm not so blind, he said heavily in passing. You've been throwing that bastard up to me for 2 hours. It doesn't take very good eyes to see what that means. It means I'm no good. I can't do anything right.
She started to say, all because I want a few little... But the boy cut in on her, anxious to help the situation somehow.
Will it shoot now? He said.
His father said nothing. His mother looked down at him, sighed, shrugged, smiled bleakly with a tight mouth. She moved aside when his father came back with a box of cartridges in his hand. He ignored her, speaking to the boy alone in the particular half-jocular tone he always used with him, or with the dog when he wasn't mad.
"Thought I had these around," he said. "Let's see what this smoke pole will do."
He slipped in a cartridge and locked the bolt, looking around for something to shoot at. Behind him, Elsa's feet moved on the floor, and her voice came purposefully.
"I can't see why you want to act this way," she said. "I'm going over to get some of those slips myself."
There was a long silence. The angled shade lay sharp as a knife across the baked front yard, and a breeze stirred in the Russian thistle of the fire guard. Beau's cheek was pressed against the stock of the gun, his arms and hands as steady as stone.
"How'll you get there?" he said, whispering down the barrel.
"I'll walk."
5 miles and back?
Yes, or 50 miles and back. If there was any earthly reason why you should mind...
I don't mind,
he said, his voice as soft as silk.
Go ahead.
Close to his mother's long skirts in the doorway, the boy felt her stiffen as if she had been slapped. He squirmed anxiously, but his desperation could find only the question he had asked before. His voice squeaked on it.
Will it shoot now?
See that sparrow out there? His father said. Right out by that cactus.
Beau, Elsa said, if you shoot that harmless little bird...
Fascinated, the boy watched his father's dark face against the rifle stock, the locked, immovable left arm, the thick finger crooked inside the trigger guard, almost too small to hold it. He saw the sparrow, gray, white-breasted, hopping obliviously in search of bugs 50 feet out on the gray earth.
I just can't bear to shoot anything,
his father said, his face like dark stone, his lips hardly moving.
I just can't stick it.
Beau!
His wife screamed. The boy's mouth opened. A dark wash of terror shadowed his vision of the bare yard and the sharp angle of shade.
Don't, Pa!
The rock-like figure of his father never moved. The thick finger squeezed down slowly. There was a thin, sharp report, and the sparrow jerked and collapsed into a shapeless wad on the ground. In the instant of the shot, all its clean outlines vanished. Head, feet, the white breast, the perceptible outlines of the folded wings disappeared all at once, crumpled together, and were lost, and the boy sat beside his father on the step with the echo of the shot thin in his ears. He did not look at either of his parents. He looked only at the crumpled sparrow. Step by step, unable to keep away, he went to it, stooped, and picked it up. Blood stained his fingers, and he held the bird by the tail while he wiped the smeared hand on his overalls. He heard the click as the bolt was shot and the empty cartridge ejected, and he saw his mother come swiftly out of the house past his father, who sat still on the step. Her hands were clenched, and she walked with her head down.
"Ma,"
the boy said dully,
"Ma, what'll I do with it?"
She stopped and turned, and for a moment they faced each other. He saw the dead pallor of her face, the burning eyes, the not-quite-controlled quiver of her lips. But her words, when they came, were flat and level, almost casual. "Leave it right there," she said. "After a while your father will want to hang it on the barbed wire." The boy dropped it and went straight away, as if by inspiration, to run his trap line. He hated his father, and he would not even stay in the same yard with him, and he hated him all up through the pasture and back along the north end of the wheat field, where the grain drooped in the withering sun. The wind, by the time he got back to the house toward evening, was blowing quite strongly from the southwest. Chapter 5. So the year that began in hope ended in bitterness. The rains that came after the blistering winds were ironic and unwanted. The crop was ruined. The prospect of a hard winter was there again, like an old unwelcome acquaintance come upon around a corner. For the boy, the farm was spoiled. The reservoir had dried up almost completely, and now was a smelly, hoof-parked, muddy hole. The creek by Pete and Emil was almost as bad. The trapping had palled, and the smell of his almost 2,000 tails when he opened the cigar box filled the sleeping porch and sickened him. There was no water for drowning gophers out. He had no more cartridges for shooting at hawks. And one night, in a blustering wind, the weasel's cage got tipped over and the weasel got away. Everything was stale. Because his father went down to Cree 3 or 4 times a week now and spent all afternoon talking with other lost and prowling homesteaders, there were practically no trips to the store anymore. The only thing that saved him from empty moping was the advent of the fall Sears Roebuck catalog and the coming of the thresher crew to rescue the remnants of the wheat. But then nothing again. The lackluster hours of hanging on the pasture gate and looking south toward the bear paws, without pleasure particularly, without longing, without anything but a dull wish that they'd go into town pretty soon. "What's the matter, son?" his mother said to him. "You go around looking like a lost soul." "I don't know," he said. He ran a finger up the rough face of a stud behind the sofa where he lay, got a sliver under the nail, and listlessly pulled it out again. "When we going into town, Ma?" "Right away, soon as Pa can get the rest of the wheat hauled. You anxious to get back?" "Uh-huh, I guess so." "Oh, Lord," she said, "me too. The change would do us all good." Then his father came back from his trip with the wagon crews, so bitter that he wouldn't even say how much he had got for the little wheat the winds had left him. And the morning after that he said they were going to get out of this godforsaken buffalo chip flat as quick as they could pack. They worked all that day, stowing in the bed of the wagon quilts, clothes, odds and ends of furniture needed in town, spare cans of gasoline and kerosene, some sacks of wheat saved for chicken and cow feed. The wagon box was more than level full when they went in to supper. And when the boy went to bed that night and lay thinking about the loaded wagon outside, the trip coming up tomorrow, the excitement of town again, school again, jet again, the house in town and the river and the brush and Halloween again, it seemed to him that the lonesome whining of the wind through the sleeping porch screen, the lonesome slatting of a half-unrolled canvas curtain, had in them all that frightened and depressed him about the homestead. It was so big outside, the stars so high and cold, the land so flat and mysterious, lying still as a shadow earth under the remote sky. You could go out in the yard and stare in every direction and never see a light unless one of the few neighbors within 5 miles was out in the yard with a lantern, or an infrequent car was moving on the Cree Road, and then it was almost worse than seeing no light at all, because it was such a faint, lost glimmer that it spread the horizons further than ever, and deepened, instead of lightening, the loneliness of wind and dark and stars and empty prairie. And tomorrow would be the 50-mile trip in, Gadkey's and the horse pasture and the Frenchman's, La Pointe's, and all the kids peeking around the stone foundations of the barn, and then there would be the south bench, the dipping of the road that angled down into the flat river valley, and below them the green belt of willows, crooked as a snake trail in sand, the dull glitter of the river, and the folded brown draws down the north bench opposite, and then the town, almost 100 houses, dozens of kids, greetings, and late shivery swims, and playing run, sheepy run again, and hare and hounds through the river brush. Before daylight he was awakened by his father's swearing and stamping around in the other room. He lay listening. The stove had run out of kerosene, and all the spare coal oil was packed far down under the mass of household goods in the wagon. The boy got out of bed and dressed swiftly, not wanting to be yelled at for oversleeping on a busy morning. But the morning was pretty well spoiled. Pa had got up on the wrong side of bed. The sun was not yet up, and the prairie outside lay gray and desolate. He turned from the screen and went into the other room, hardly responding to his mother's good morning. There was a dull and dispirited weight on his mind. He couldn't wake up properly, and his mouth kept opening in jaw-cracking yawns. His father came inside with the kerosene can, saw him standing there stupidly, and told him sharply to do something, for God's sake. Did he think the world moved on wheels to get his breakfast and carry him into town? Go up and get the horses. He went sullenly in the gray light, searching the corners of the pasture for the outlines of the team. In the east, light grew, and turning his head, he saw the pearly band along the horizon touched with rose. He stumbled in a badger hole and cursed like his father, kicking the mounded earth. When he returned with the team, breakfast was on the table and his mother was already eating. His father was frying slices of bread in bacon fat. The boy slid into his chair and his father turned to glower at him. "Have you washed?" "No," the boy said sullenly. At the bench outside in the full rosy light, he dabbed his face and hands and threw out the water. The sun's glaring saucer slipped over the flat horizon and touched him. That and the dash of cold water on his face made him feel better. The headachy feeling he had waked up to, the sort of feeling he had when a bilious spell was coming on, was almost gone. In a little while, his mind said, they would be heading for White Mud, and that would be fine. "Are we going to leave right after breakfast, Mom?" "I am. I'm going to start with the wagon, and you and Pa are going to finish up here, and then you're coming in the car." The boy looked toward the stove. His father's dark face, even in profile, looked grouchy, dissatisfied, mad. "Ma, I want to go with you." "I'm afraid you can't," she said. "Pa needs you to help him." She smiled at him, squinting her eyes and warning him, reminding him not to make a fuss, not to whine, not to get Pa's temper started. He understood her look, but he fussed anyway. The prospect of riding all the way with his father was suddenly dreadful to him. "Well, I want to," he said. "I want to go in the wagon with you."
"You do as you're told," his father said, and slapped another slice of bread into the pan. The boy sat pouting, accusing his mother silently. She had betrayed him. Her face was weary as she reached out to pat his hand.
"Don't worry," she said. "I won't get very far before you catch me. You can change off then."
He was carrying old boards up to the house for shuttering when his mother climbed into the wagon seat atop the monstrous load and gathered up the lines. He dropped the boards and ran to open the gate, and as the wagon went through with his father walking at the wheel, his mother smiled down at the boy and blew him a kiss off the ends of her heavy gloves. She looked so funny up there with a straw hat on that he laughed.
"Don't try to hurry it," his father said. "You've got a heavy load and a colt along. Let the team make its own speed. We'll probably catch you the other side of the horse pasture somewhere."
"All right."
Sitting on her high seat, she smiled down on them.
"Bye, son."
Her eyes went back to the little round-topped shack on the other side of the coulee, and she stood up to raise an arm.
"So long, homestead," she said. "We'll be back."
She met Beau's eyes briefly, held them, and flapped the lines over the horses. The laden wagon creaked heavily, rocking through the burnouts. 100 feet away, she turned and waved, and the boy waved back, mechanically, watching the wagon crawl into the blazing east.
All right, his father said. Let's get a move on.
Back at the house, he started nailing boards over the two windows, rolling down the porch blinds and cleating them fast. He sent the boy for the three chicken crates, saved from the spring, and they ran down all the hens and put them squawking into the boxes. The boy loaded them in the Ford while his father lugged the rain barrel and all the loose tools inside. The plow went into the chicken house. The stone boat was leaned up against the wall. Then there was the last-minute gleaning of the house, the loose bundles of odds and ends, the leftover food in a cardboard box, the cat, the dog, the almost-forgotten cigar box of gopher tails, and finally the moment when they stood in the door looking back into the darkened, unfamiliar cave of the house, and the last shutting of the door.
"Want anything to eat before we start?" his father said.
He had the box of leftover food, ready to load it into the Ford.
"No," the boy said. "I don't feel very good."
His father looked at him sharply, and his brows drew down. "What do you mean you don't feel very good?"
"I feel kind of sick to my stomach,"
the boy said, and stood lugubrious and resentful under his father's harsh glare.
"Oh, Jesus," his father said finally. "You would.
Well, get in." The boy walked out to the gate, closed it when the Ford passed through, and climbed in. His father needn't act as if a person got sick just for fun. He belched, testing himself, and thought with forlorn satisfaction that he would probably have to throw up pretty soon. He could feel his insides rolling as the Ford lurched, and he tasted deep inside himself for that old, familiar, awful, bitter taste of a sour stomach. He thought that the belch had it just a little.
"How are you feeling?" his father said as they passed Pete and Emil.
"Kind of sick," the boy said.
He tasted again, thinking how bad it was that his mother had gone off and left him, and now here he was going to have a bilious spell, and nobody with him but Pa, who didn't ever have any patience with sickness, even though he had plenty of sick headaches himself. He belched again, and the gall burned his throat. Misery went through him. He was sick, and all Pa would do about it was to get mad and think he did it on purpose to make things unpleasant. Brine flooded his mouth. He swallowed, belched again, felt the blood drain from his face, and hung on to the side of the car.
"Pa," he said, "Pa, I got to throw up."
Through his fear and misery, he saw his father's sideward face, the exasperation, the irritation, just short of swearing, but no sympathy, no pity. He began to bawl, and as the Ford rolled to a stop in the narrow wagon track, he leaned out and vomited over the side. When Elsa turned to look back for the last time, she saw the broad body of her husband, the slight one of her son, standing together at the gate, and behind them the shanty and the vanishing line of fence dipping down the coulee. Bruce's figure looked thin, spidery, somehow pathetic, and she waved, watching his arm come up. His face remained steadily fixed in her direction. Poor lamb, he'd had a lonesome summer. It would be a treat for him to get back to town. The sun's glare was bright in her eyes, and she bent her head away from it. Almost 50 miles to go, and no roads to speak of for the first 15. Just wagon tracks that split and branched and wandered through the buffalo grass. It would have been much nicer if Brucey could have come with her, someone to talk to. And he didn't want to ride with Beau. He'd been a little sullen with Beau ever since the shooting of the sparrow. She sighed, wondering if all boys held things against their fathers as a kind of natural reaction against authority, or if Bruce were going to be a grudge-holder, or if, maybe, she thought of the hot-cold river and the picnic and the bear paws. If he might remember something about that time back in Washington. She put her foot on the trailing lines and wriggled out of her coat. Letting the team plod on, she pushed up her sleeves and opened the throat of her blouse. It was already hot. The scar on her right arm caught her eye. In 6 years the shiny red had faded, but it always reacted to sunburn violently and was redder than the tan of the unharmed skin. There was a ridge of tight scar in the elbow that wouldn't quite let her straighten the arm out. That was one relic of the days she wanted to forget.
could there be, she wondered, another relic in the mind of that child? Would he, at 4 years, have hatred and fear so burned into him that the scar would never leave?
She laughed at herself and picked up the lines. Put me by myself, she said. Just let me sit alone for a few hours, and I'll sure worry something up.
She sat looking at the base of the wagon tongue, watching the single trees jerk, staring half-seeing at the black hairs snagged in the bolt of the double tree. Her mind doubled on itself, avoiding things as a horse shies. She didn't want to think of those things. But there was the look on Bruce's face as he watched his father, the old familiar feel in the air of hard times and restlessness, as definite and recognizable as a weather change to a rheumatic old man. The prairie lay around her, withered and pitted and brown like a very old face, but she didn't see it. Her eyes were fixed on the space between the horses, and her mind went back beyond Washington, beyond Dakota, back to Minnesota, where it started, back to Indian Falls, when she was 18 and had run away from what she couldn't bear, or thought she couldn't bear. Her mother might have stayed and borne it and made some kind of triumph out of it. But when you were 18, you didn't know what you knew when you were 32. And because you were 18 and proud and blind and full of high notions, you ran away like a coward and called it the only decent thing to do. She couldn't run away from this and wasn't going to. Only she wished that the still, breezeless air didn't carry that threat of storm, and that the rheumatic joints of her old worrying mind didn't ache with the fear of something. She looked up. She was approaching Gadkey's, and Mrs. Gadkey was in the yard, her apron full of chicken feed. She came to the road to meet the wagon, her greeting so warm and hearty that Elsa heard the loneliness and isolation in it. Farm women were always lonely. There were never enough visitors to satisfy their itch to talk, and up here there were probably not half a dozen a year. She leaned down to shake Mrs. Gadkey's hand.
"Well, well," Mrs. Gadkey said, "moving in again."
Elsa took off her hat and fanned herself and laughed. "Seems like we're always loaded up going somewhere."
"I wish I was," Mrs. Gadkey said.
She looked at the loaded wagon with envy.
"Come in and have a cup of coffee and a bite."
"I shouldn't," Elsa said. "Beau and Bruce are coming in the car, and I ought to be covering ground."
"Oh, come on in," Mrs. Gadkey said. "You can spare 20 minutes. We don't see you folks more than twice a year."
Elsa let herself be tempted down. She sat in the kitchen and had a cup of coffee and looked at Mrs. Gadkey's brilliant row of geraniums, more than a dozen, in a wooden box under the window.
"Your plants are pretty," she said. "Moving as much as we do, I can't seem to keep flowers going. I just get some nice plants started in town, and we have to leave them with somebody or bring them out here. And if we leave them, they get forgotten and die, and if we bring them, they get broken."
"They're a comfort," Mrs. Gadkey said. "But if I could talk Gadkey into going in for the winter, I'd sure be glad to do without."
"I notice you've got a rose bush outside."
"Gadkey put that in for me last spring. Seems to be doing all right. I dump my dish water on it every day. It's a climbing kind. White blossoms."
"It'll be lovely when it blooms," Elsa said. "There are some people over by us, some English people named Garfield, that have planted trees in their coulee. He used to work in a greenhouse, and he thinks they'll grow."
She knew while she said it that she was envying Mrs. Gadkey her geraniums and that rose bush, and that she envied the Garfields their trees. But what she really envied in both of them was the permanence they had. They had both made up their minds to settle down and stick. They weren't bonanza farmers gambling against the rains. Or if they gambled, they risked their whole lives. And it was only on that assumption that you could be comfortable in a place. She rose. "I really have to get on," she said. "It's a long drive in the wagon."
"I suppose you'll be out again come spring," Mrs. Gadkey said. "Plan to stop off and stay the night. Then you could get a good start and have the morning to shake down in your own place."
"Thank you," Elsa said. "That's nice of you."
She put her foot on the hub and took hold of the dusty iron tire, hoisting herself up.
"I don't know," she said, looking down.
Bo's so discouraged about the crop this year that I don't know whether we'll ever be out again. I had a kind of feeling this morning when I drove off that I was saying goodbye for good.
"Of course you'll be back," Mrs. Gadke said.
She stood back as the wagon started, and Elsa turned three times to wave to the stout, aproned figure before she dipped down into the first rolling country and climbed off to open the horse-pasture gate. Ahead of her was 15 miles without house or field, just one immense pasture with herds of horses thundering away from the wagon, standing on high ground to stare with ears up, whickering loudly, curiously, and putting the team into a state of nervousness and scaring the colt so that he hugged his mother's side. The wagon rocked, the road over the rolling ground was rougher and rockier, and the seat was hard. She folded her coat and sat on it, and the team went steadily. The trees seesawed, the tugs slacked and tightened, the double-tree bolt squeaked, and she felt the weight of the wagon like a falling thing whenever the wheels rolled solidly over a hump and jounced down. "You never like what you've got," she was thinking. Mrs. Gadke, with something permanent and good started there, wanted to leave it and come to town for the winter. You had to stay in a place to make it a home. A home had to be lived in every day, every month, every year, for a long time, till it was worn like an old shoe and fitted the comfortable curvatures of your life. It was almost 11 before she heard the tooting of the Ford's horn and looked back to see it behind her. She turned off the road and stopped, and Bruce got out of the car and into the seat beside her. Elsa took one look at his greenish-white face and wrapped her arms around him.
"Oh, what's the matter?" she said.
"Sick to his stomach," Beau said from the car. His lips went down in a wry, deprecatory grimace. Stroking the boy's thin back, Elsa said,
"Maybe he should go on with you. I'll be hours behind."
"He doesn't want to go with me," Beau said, and pressed his lips together. She saw that he was irritable, sore, exasperated, ready to bite.
"All right," she said. "You go on, then."
She watched him pull ahead in the trail. Bruce lay down with his feet in her lap and his straw hat over his face. Within a mile they came to the other edge of the pasture. Bo had left the gate open, and she knew from that how cranky he was. He was usually as fussy as an old woman about gates. When she got up again after closing it, Bruce was sitting up, looking forlorn and pinched around the mouth.
"Feel better?"
"No," he said sullenly.
"You'd better lie down again." "I don't want to lie down."
She let him have his contrary way while they rocked over the last mile of ruts to the junction with the Robsart Road. He wanted, she knew, to be sympathized with, and if he wanted that, he wasn't as sick as he pretended to be. When he got a real sick headache, he was in bed for 2 days. Bruce squirmed sullenly. He said, "Pa got mad at me for being sick."
"You couldn't help being sick," she said. "He wouldn't get mad at you for that."
"Well, he did."
"Pa's just disappointed about the crop," she said. "He's got a lot of worries on his mind. He wasn't mad at you."
The boy pulled his straw hat down over his eyes and glowered under the brim.
"I hate Pa," he said.
Elsa reached out and shook him hard.
"I don't want you talking like that. Understand?"
Its shoulders contracted under her hands, and bending to look at his face, she saw his old expression of stony, stubborn implacability. It was useless to try to talk to him when he wore that look, but she shook him again anyway and said,
"Pa's doing the best he can. That's all any of us can do. We've all got to do the best we can and help all we can."
She said no more to him for a long time, and there was nothing on the road to interest him. He sat for a while, slumped, lurching with the wagon, thinking how he hated his father, and how when he got big enough he would run away, and after a while he would come back rich and well-dressed and grown up, and take Chet and Ma away to live with him, and if Pa wanted to come too, he'd just turn his big McLaughlin around and drive off and leave him standing there. After a time he lay down, and his mother said,
"Feeling sick again?"
"No." "You might as well keep lying down anyway," she said. "It'll be 3 hours at least before we're there. You can go right to bed when we get back. I feel all right."
He lay quietly, his straw hat over his face and his legs sprawled over the boxes piled in front of the seat. His mind slipped away from how he hated his father, caught for a spiteful minute, wandered off again to consider what he would do when they got to town. The thought of town made him squirm his back and keep his eyes shut the way he did when he was having a nice dream and didn't want to wake up. He nursed the pictures that came to him, went painstakingly around and through everything that town meant and everything that made summer and winter different. In summer it was the farm, and freedom and loneliness, and the clean sharpening of the senses, the feeling of strong personal identity in the midst of a wide, cleanly bounded world. But the rest of the year it was the town, sunk in its ancient river valley, hemmed in by the Bench Hills, and that was another life. That life centered around the three houses on the cutbank side of the West Bend, and the bathhouses behind on the bank, that the boy got to use only for a short time in the spring. In winter there were used as storehouses by the three families in that end of the town. His feet knew the path, rutted hard with frost or deep in snow, that went out past the barn to the bathhouses. His fingers knew the cut of the bale and the icy slop of water as he lugged buckets from the chopped hole in the river ice, staggering lopsidedly up the dugway from the footbridge head. His fingers knew, too, the sticky bite of a frosty doorknob. They knew the clumsy fumbling with the bathhouse key when he was sent out to bring a chunk of frozen beef or pork in from the still, cold, faintly urine and wet bathing suit-smelling shanty. His nose knew bathhouse smell and barn smell and kitchen smell and the smell of baking paint behind the red-hot parlor heater, and those were town. Town was Preacher Morrison and the Sunday school parties where they played beanbag and crokinole. It was birthday parties the girls gave, and the bolt of hair ribbon that Mr. O'Roulian cut from when you went in to spend your 2 bits for a present. It was McGregor's hardware store with the smell of stove blacking and turpentine and the tallowy smell of the baled muskrat skins on the back counter. It was the Pastime movie theater, where every Friday night there was a new installment of The Black Box, or Tarzan of the Apes, or The Red Ace. It was the boys, Weddy O'Roulian, or Preacher Kid Morrison, that the cave caved in on last spring, or Bill Brewer, or the Heathcliff kids from across the river, the bunch he went skating with around the river's bitter bends, spreading his mackinaw to the wind on the way back and skimming like a bird up to the fires and slush and noise by the cut bank. Town was many things. Was the irrigation dam of old man Purcell, where they trapped muskrats and weasels and once a mink. The willow breaks, where in late fall the gang of little kids built huts of branches, playing they were holing up for the winter. Huts which the big kid gang, Chet among them, always discovered and tore down. It was the smell of dry willow leaves crushed and rolled in tissue paper and smoked, the taste of wild rose hips nibbled on an October afternoon, the numb blue-white of snow moons, when the crowd of them rode on a bob behind Pete Purcell's pony up the long, swift-current hill, their hand-sleds stretched out in a black line behind. It was the game they played after a heavy blizzard when they tunneled down through the overhanging drifts piled against the cutbanks, making a smooth, packed burrow through which they could dive in a breathless belly ride and skid, snowy and yelling, onto the river ice. The town was White Mud, Saskatchewan, what Beau Mason, when he was disgusted, was likely to call a dirty little dung-heeled sagebrush town. But to the boy it was society, civilization, a warm place of home where his mother sat sewing long hours under the weak light of the north windows, singing sometimes to herself, making dresses for girls who were going to be married or for women who lived up on Millionaire Row. The town was school, the excitement of books, the Ridpath History of the World that he had read entirely through by his 8th birthday. His mother, telling that to neighbors, always spoke with awe in her voice, and her pride in his brains sent him scrabbling for anything else in the old bookcase upstairs that he had not already read. Mostly it was novels like The Rock in the Baltic and Graustark and The Three Musketeers. Town, home, was that and more. It was the steel engravings in Ridpath, the Rape of the Sabine Women, that he puzzled over and finally asked his mother about, to be told that he shouldn't be so everlastingly curious. It was the sixth-grade room where they sang God Save the King, and In Days of Yore from Britain's Shore, and The March of the Men of Harlech, and the boys sang with tears in his eyes because the songs were heroic, and Miss Crow's brother was in the army, and Canada was at war with the Huns. Bruce was a better scholar than Chet, but Chet was a better singer, and in all the cantatas the school gave. Chet was strong, too, and had licked Weddy Aurelian and Pete Purcell, and had almost licked Tad McGovern. Town was things that had happened, like the time he had shot himself through the toe with Chet's .22, the numb moment before he knew he was hurt, when he thought somebody had hit him in the foot with a rock, and stood there with the .22 in his hand, wondering what had made the noise, until he saw the sole ripped clear off his shoe, and the leather bloody. Town was winter, the river ice full of air bubbles like silver coins, and the wonder of a Chinook in the midst of bitter cold, when he woke to the wail of a blizzard, and looked out to see no blizzard at all, but a thaw, the eaves of Chance's house dripping, the roof melted black, the ground a lake of slush and water, and the wind coming through the three little portholes of the storm windows warm as milk. Town was the four-gabled white house his father had built when the town was first settled in 1914, the room where he and Chet lay in bed making pictures of dragons and trains and animals and angels among the blotches left by the firemen's chemicals when the attic had caught fire. It was the parlor downstairs, the piano his mother was so fond of, the big-bellied round oak stove with the asbestos pad underneath and the scuttle of lignite behind it. It was his mother darning, and sometimes his father reading or reciting Robert W. Service. This is the law of the Yukon, and ever she makes it plain. Send not your foolish and feeble, send but your strong and your sane. Sometimes, too, it was stories when his father was feeling good, exciting stories about the Wisconsin woods and the terrible Swede, and Little Pete the Wanigan boy, and Paul Bunyan, and Hot Biscuit Slim. When the boys were finally shooed off to bed, going reluctantly up the cold stairs and looking back wanting more, Bruce always had a strong feeling of home and warmth and security on nights like that, when his father was jovial and full of yarns. He knew his mother liked those, too. She never had the tired look in her shoulders, the puckery squint around her eyes, the habit of looking as if she saw something through the wall. His mother's hand touched him, and she said, "Well, son, there's the big city." He sat up and looked. They were starting down the dugway. Below them lay the river valley and the looping bends, and at the top of the big U-bend the houses of white mud. He pushed his hat back and watched as they went down carefully, the wooden brake shoes sizzling on the tires like sandpaper, the horses' rumps hunched back, braced into the breeching against the push of the load. The colt limped along beside Daisy, fell behind, trotted tiredly to catch up. "Poor little thing," Elsa said. "That's an awful trip for a poor little colt." Bruce snapped his fingers and whistled at the lagging colt. "Come on, Peggy," he said. "We're pretty near there." "Glad?" his mother said. "Uh-huh. So am I," she said, and laughed. "Or I would be if I knew what we were going to live on this winter."
Part 5 Chapter 1
"What?" said Beau to himself, sitting and thinking, trying to figure away the winter that stretched ahead. "Would an Indian do to make sure of eating for those 7 months? How would some pioneer off in the wilderness provide for his family? There were the cows and the chickens.
He had already figured them, one cow fresh and one due to freshen in 2 months. There might be a little milk to sell, and there might be a few extra eggs from their dozen hens. But that was almost all. The jobs he could do, he had done. He had spent 3 frantic weeks cutting fall hay on the north bench, had borrowed a baler so that he'd be able to get more into the small loft he had. There might be some of that to sell if he turned the horses loose on the range and kept only the cows and the colt inside. And he had hauled 5 wagon loads of lignite from the hillside west of the railroad bridge, enough to keep them warm for the winter. It was lousy fuel, half ash and half rock, but it was better than nothing, and it was free. So, he said, figuring, they could keep warm and they could depend on milk and eggs. They might make a dime a day from their extra milk, maybe 30 cents a day when the muley freshened. There might be $30 or $40 worth of extra hay. The town owed him $10 for his annual job of taking out the footbridge before the river froze over. And that was all. That was absolutely, by God, he thought angrily, that was absolutely all. The little money he had got from the wheat would pay their bills and buy a few necessities, but there wouldn't be anything left in the spring for seed, for summer supplies, for anything. Grind your own wheat, he said. Slaughter your own hogs, if you had a hog. Might be a good idea to try picking one up, even this late. It was cheaper on the hoof than it was in Jaime's shop. A beef was out, but he might find some farmer who was slaughtering and had a quarter to spare. But what else? There had to be something else. What would an Indian do? Game? He considered it, weighing the cost of shells against the possible addition to the food supply. In Dakota they had sometimes frozen ducks and geese down, and fur. There were all those traps of the kids, and the north bench was full of muskrat sloughs. And fur was high. It would be small pickings, maybe, but better than sitting on your prat. He rose from the table, went to the window, and looked into the square of front yard that 2 years ago had been hopefully seeded to lawn. The 2 spruces that he had gone clear up to the Cypress Hills for stood withered and dead at the corners of the house. That was the way with everything in the whole damn town. It started out big and just dwindled away. He compressed his lips, breathed in a great lungful of air, went to the cellarway and took out his shotgun. The hell with just sitting around wondering and figuring. He would fill that bathhouse so full of meat, by God, that they'd eat duck 3 times a day and have some left over for the 4th of July. So through the waning days of mid-October, in the chill, leaden, snow-spitting weather, he spent days on the north bench after ducks. He built a blind and sat patiently for whole mornings at a time with his feet slowly going dead through the heavy socks and waders, watching the sky and the bobbing decoys riding the shallow, riffled water. He sat in the wind with the mangy dogskin coat around his ears, and when a flock circled and came back, he crouched lower, shaking the coat off onto the packed, damp tules. And as they came in, he let them have it, taking no chances, trying no fancy shots, letting them come clear down even, shooting sitting birds, because there was no limit in this kind of hunting. He was after a winter's meat. The first day, red-nosed and wind-burned, he brought in 14 ducks. The next day he got only 8. The day after that he had a carful of teal and mallard and spoonbill and 1 goose. In a week he brought in over 100 birds. They had eaten duck until the very sight of one turned their stomachs. Elsa and the boys had plucked ducks until their fingers were sore, because duck down, Beau said, made good pillows, and pillows were things people always wanted. Elsa could get some ticking and make a lot of pillows, and you ought to get a buck apiece for them. He was driven by such a furious compulsion to fill the house with game that Elsa laughed at him, asking him when he was going to start saving tea lead and string, and he was irritated and hurt that she couldn't see how necessary it was to save every penny. For himself, he was a miser. The thought of all the money he had squandered in the past 10 years tortured him. The necessity of saving everything, making use of everything, living off the land, was an obsession that hardly let him sleep. Elsa tried to make him stop,
People were talking about the flu that was spreading around the country. John Chapman said that if it came anywhere close, he was hitting for California. It would be a hard and cold and long winter, even if the flu didn't get to them, and Bo's going out and catching pneumonia in a slough wouldn't make it any easier. She might as well have saved her breath. He kept up his hunting. She picked a dozen or two dozen ducks every day.